An Israeli newspaper gloated, "Got 'em," and showed pictures of Palestinian prisoners in their underwear with their hands up. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas described it as an unforgivable crime. Both referred to yesterday's raid by Israeli troops on a prison in the Palestinian city of Jericho. After a day-long siege, the Israelis captured the 6 men they wanted and took along a couple of hundred more. While Israelis celebrated, the raid set off demonstrations, strikes, and kidnappings in the Palestinian territories. Britain and the United States came in for bitter criticism because those two countries removed monitors from the prison only a few minutes before the Israelis arrived. The raid and the response come at a sensitive moment. Negotiations are still underway on the formation of a new Palestinian government following the victory of Hamas in elections earlier this year. Israel's elections are now 2 weeks off. An embarrassed President Abbas returned early from a diplomatic trip to Europe, while acting Prime Minister Ehud Olmert received widespread applause in Israel. In London and in Washington, new questions arose about their role in the raid and about their credibility with Palestinians. Later in the program, savvy traveler Rudy Maxa on what the airlines will charge us for next, but first, the Jericho prison raid. If you have questions about what happened, why, or about the implications, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. Joining us now is Amos Harel, a reporter for the newspaper Haaretz, and he's with us by phone from his home in Tel Aviv. Very good of you to be with us this evening.
Good afternoon.
Can you tell us what happened yesterday briefly?
Well, the British and American monitors who were keeping an eye on what was going on in the Palestinian prison for about 4 years, ever since I think May of 2002, have decided to leave urgently yesterday morning. It took only a few minutes, but after that there were hundreds of Israeli soldiers surrounding the jail inside Jericho, demanding that the 6 wanted men would surrender and give themselves up to the Israelis. It took about 9.5 hours of siege. There was a lot of gunfire exchange, but in the end, by the evening, the men were out, and now the 6 men are arrested. A few dozens more are still held by the Israelis, and about 300 Palestinians were already released and given back to the Palestinian Authority.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to this deal in 2002. These men, 5 members of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a group that's part of the PLO, and another man who's believed to be the financier of the drug smuggling effort aboard the boat Karen A. They were in the office of Yasser Arafat, who was under siege at that time, and there was a deal brokered for the release of these men. They would be tried under Palestinian law and held in a Palestinian jail, not turned over to the Israelis, but American and British monitors would keep track of them.
Exactly. This was the deal that actually allowed Arafat to get out of the first Israeli siege of April of 2002. It is the leader of the PFLP, Mr. Ahmed Saadat, who decided to retaliate the Israeli assassination of his predecessor, Abu Ali Mustafa, in August of 2001. And he was actually the man responsible, at least by Israeli claims, for the murder, for the assassination of an Israeli minister, Chavam Ze'evi, in October of 2001. This is why it was so urgent for Israel to arrest him, and also 4 other men who were involved in the assassination. And after 5 weeks of siege, the decision was made that they would be allowed to move to Jericho as long as the Americans and the British would be monitoring what was happening in the jail. But since the election, the great victory of the Hamas in the election 2 months before, there was a lot of tensions around this, and the Hamas was already saying, the Hamas leaders were already saying that they would let these men go once they are in power. Israel announced that it wouldn't be able to live with that, and once the British wardens were out, Israel was inside a jail.
Mm-hmm. Was there any indication, and we should point out that Mr. Sadat ran for and was elected to a seat in the Palestinian parliament in those elections,
True.
But was there any indication that the Americans and the British, the monitors at the prison, had they tipped off the Israelis that they were going to leave?
The Americans, the Brits, and also the Israelis are, of course, denying that. But there was a statement made by an Israeli army commander saying that it took them only 6 minutes to arrive. The soldiers, there were only 6 minutes in between the wardens leaving and the army coming in. So, you know, Jericho is a small town, but yet 6 minutes. It seems that Israel had at least some idea of the British and American plans. And, of course, there was a letter sent by the British and American consuls in East Jerusalem in March 8, if I'm not mistaken, telling the Chairman Abbas that they could not go on with the present condition inside the jail, and if anything isn't done, then they might have to leave. So Israel, of course, was ready to act, and once they decided to leave, it didn't take much time for the army to reach the jail.
Yes, and President Abbas, touring the ruins of the prison in Jericho today, said, the Americans and the British leave, the Israelis are here. A few moments later, draw your own conclusions.
He blamed them quite directly.
And the other part of it we overlooked. I mean, the assault on the prison was quite violent, as you said. Walls were knocked down, and in gunfire, I believe one Palestinian policeman and one of the prisoners was killed.
Yes, but on the other hand, this was this was done in a very populated area. If you consider the fact that so many soldiers were there and so many people inside, then the casualties weren't as bad as one might expect. It wasn't a terrible battle going on, and actually Israel managed to finish this operation without so many deaths on both sides. It was feared, but actually the at least the Israelis see this as quite a successful army operation.
And what is to happen with the men they took away now?
This hasn't been decided yet. There is, of course, the question of double jeopardy. They have been put on trial in the Palestinian Authority in that month of April or May of 2002. The war claims then that it was a sort of a mock trial, that it was very speedily done, and Arafat was only doing that because of the American and British pressure. And now these are the claims brought by the Israelis, saying, "Well, we can put them on trial again because of that." But there still hasn't been a decision made. I think tomorrow morning there should be it should be debated at the Israeli Justice Department, and there is, of course, a chance that they will be kept in jail in Israel because of the sentences they received under a Palestinian court.
And because there is some concern that Israel simply just can't try them again. They've already been tried for these crimes.
Exactly, double jeopardy, as I said.
Yes. The other people, you said, for the most part, they've been released?
Most of them, I think about 30 or 40 people, are still kept under arrest. Israeli security services are saying that some of them were involved in acts of terrorism, and they still haven't made up their mind. They'll probably investigate them. I guess some more would be released in the next few days.
Mm-hmm. And the raid is being hailed, from what I've been able to read of the Israeli media, almost across the board.
Yeah, it has, of course, political consequences. As you know, we're expecting the elections here in less than 2 weeks. The Israeli acting prime minister Ehud Olmert is running for office. It's his first time. It has many implications, many political implications. I guess that most Israelis see this as a justified act. The average voter on the street would tell you that that Olmert had no choice, that he would be, that Israel would have been humiliated if these men would have been let to go free, and this is why they should have been arrested. Luckily for Olmert, the operation succeeded. If it would have turned up as something like the siege in Ramallah or on the church in Bethlehem in 2002, it might have been very difficult for Olmert. The only question remains, would the PFLP or other Palestinian organizations retaliate soon, before the elections? If Israelis are killed in some act of retaliation, this might harm Olmert in the election.
Amos Harel, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Amos Harel, a reporter for the newspaper Haaretz, joined us by phone from his home in Tel Aviv. The raid unleashed a wave of anger among Palestinians who, as we mentioned, in part blame Britain and the United States. Joining us now to talk about that is Mohammed Yaghi, executive director of the Palestinian Center for Mass Communication, with us by phone from his home in Ramallah. Thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for you.
Is Palestinian reaction, which was so negative yesterday, is that continuing today?
Well, I think today it's a little bit calm than yesterday. And I didn't hear news today, for example, saying anything about kidnapping any foreigners or any other demonstration in the streets, except that some marches in the streets condemning what the Israeli did yesterday.
And there were 11 Westerners of various types or foreigners kidnapped yesterday. I believe all of them were released before the end of the day.
Yeah, they were. All of them were released a few hours after they were kidnapped yesterday. Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about Ahmed Sadat and his standing with Palestinians.
Well, Ahmed Sadat is he's a teacher. He's he used to be a teacher. In fact, he used to teach mathematics. He's an old member of the Palestinian Popular Front. Then he succeeded Abu Ali Mustafa. When Abu Ali Mustafa was assassinated, he was elected as the leader of the Popular Front. He resisted the occupation for a long period of time. He flee from the Israeli prison for almost 11 years. He was able to hide before the Palestinian Authority came in 1994. So he's a hero for the Palestinians. He's not a simple guy.
Mm-hmm. Stay with us, if you would, Mohammed Yaghi. We have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue speaking about the raid in Jericho yesterday and its implications. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Cowan, and it's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and we're talking today about yesterday's raid on a prison in Jericho by Israeli forces. And with us from Ramallah is Mohammed Yaghi, executive director of the Palestinian Center for Mass Communication. Just before the break, you were explaining to us that the principal figure involved in this raid, from the Israeli point of view, the man they most wanted, Ahmed Sadat, is considered a hero by many Palestinians. How is this going to, do you think, affect politics there in the territories? You're still in the middle of negotiations trying to form a new government.
Well, I think basically the main issue is that when the Americans and the Quartet are saying that Hamas needs to commit itself with the agreement that the Palestinian Authority made before, and this is an example of how the American and the British did with the previous agreement. This is not a good precedent for the American and the British.
So the withdrawal of those
to convince Hamas to accept the already agreement had been made.
So the Palestinians see the withdrawal of the prison monitors just in advance of the raid as the Americans and the British working hand in glove with the Israelis.
Well, this was very obvious for the Palestinians. The monitors left the prisons only a few minutes before the Israeli soldiers arrived. Today, for example, Abbas said that he knew that the monitors will leave the prison, but they didn't tell him when. And the Israelis knew just a few minutes after that they left the prison. So it was clear that this incident happened with coordination with the Israelis.
And one more question before we let you go, and that is this a setback for Mahmoud Abbas?
this is a big setback for Mr. Mahmoud Abbas, because Mahmoud Abbas depends on the international support for his not only survival, but for convincing the Palestinians that leaving violence and depending on the international support will solve their own problems. But now, if the international community is abandoning Abbas, then he can't convince them that he can bring anything to them.
Mohamed Yaghi, thanks very much. We appreciate your time.
Thanks.
Mohamed Yaghi, Executive Director of the Palestinian Center for Mass Communication, who joined us by phone from his home in Ramallah. With us now is Hirsch Goodman, Senior Research Associate at the Jaffe Center for Strategic Studies at Tel Aviv University, a political columnist for the Jerusalem Report. He's with us by phone from his home in Tel Aviv. Always good to speak with you, Hirsch Goodman.
Thank you.
And let me ask you a question also about politics. This comes 2 weeks before elections in Israel. Does anybody take that as a coincidence?
I think you could be very cynical and say they planned this and, you know, it's good for Umat and so on and so forth. But these things can also go very wrong. And if this had ended with, God forbid, 200 killed Palestinian prisoners and 15 Israeli soldiers dead, which it could have happened, it wouldn't have been very good politically for him. So I don't think it was orchestrated politically.
Nevertheless, the results, at least so far, look pretty good for Mr. Olmert and the centrist Kadima Party.
Yes, there's no question about that. Umat, for the last few weeks, has had to establish himself as a leader. He wasn't elected into this position. He fell into it when Sharon got ill. And he had to prove himself in a leadership capacity. So he's done a few things, the most dramatic of which is spell out exactly what he intends to do over the next 4 years in terms of unilateral withdrawal from more territory. Of course, leaving the door open for negotiations if these happen. And I think he's established himself as a person that can make a firm decision with what happened here yesterday.
Mm-hmm. While there may be some concern outside of Israel, the response inside of Israel seems to be overwhelmingly positive.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the moment that Hamas got elected to be basically the Palestinian government, it was very clear to us that they were going to release these people. Some of them were responsible for the death, the assassination of an Israeli minister, dozens of terror attacks. And I think the Israeli public, just like they supported going to Argentine to get Eichmann and similar things in the past, support this fully.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. And Danny joins us. Danny calling from Detroit.
Yeah, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I just want to say that what Olmert did is a big mistake. And he doesn't have the planning capacity that Sharon has. And I don't think that he did this without owing the British and the Americans something. And I think he has to pay them back when military action against Iran commences. Hmm. I think Israel will have to play a leading role. And it's unfortunate because there is no more Jewish leadership in Israel. Hmm. I mean, Sharon was the last cat, if you would. You know, there is no more leadership. There is no more deep philosophical founding leadership in Israel, no more. And this is the existential threat to Israel. No more leadership.
Let's ask Hirsch Goodman about that. Obviously, any pending operations against Iran seem an awfully long way down the road, if ever. But anyway.
That was a pretty... First of all, there is leadership in Israel. There's very good leadership in Israel. And the fact that we've been through both the Gaza disengagement, which passed flawlessly, even though there were great threats to democracy here, and Sharon's incapacitation shows leadership. There's a very good young generation of politicians who've entered the political arena this time. Even though the three leaders of the three big parties aren't particularly exciting. I mean, Netanyahu, we've had him before.
Benjamin Netanyahu, the head of the Likud party.
Yes, Netanyahu, the head of the Likud party. He doesn't have much public credibility. Umat came in only 34th on the primaries list of the Likud party at the time. He's not a very popular politician. And Amir Peretz is leading the Labour Party. I mean, for many Israelis, looks like Stalin, speaks like Stalin, behaves like Stalin. So we don't have great leadership at the top of the parties, but there's a very, very young, talented, educated, erudite, well-traveled group of young people who've entered politics this time around. And I think we'll see them maturing in 4 years' time.
Let's talk now with Kate. And Kate's with us from Oberlin Park in Kansas.
Hi. I guess my first response to the news report, Neil, was kind of, oh, God, it's shades of Abu Ghraib and that humiliation.
Mm-hmm.
But then once you explained who the prisoners were, you have to ask yourself what neighboring country, or, you know, put it into a state situation in the United States or anywhere, would allow a convicted felon, you know, particularly one who had assassinated one of that country's leaders, to just go free. I mean, I don't come down necessarily on one side of the Middle Eastern problem or the other, but just from a practical standpoint, how could the Palestinians not have understood how provocatory this act of releasing these prisoners, or saying they were going to release these prisoners, would be? And frankly, how could the United States have not helped in some way?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, if they were innocent, or if there had not been a trial or something. So that's my question, and I'll take my answer off.
All right, Kate, thanks very much for the call. Hirsch?
Yes, well, obviously I agree that no country would allow that to happen. And the thing is this, I think there's a bit of a misunderstanding here, and I think we should clarify it. The Palestinian Authority arrested these people after they did the assassination here in Israel. There was a whole long discussion. At the end, it was agreed that there would be an American and a British oversight team to make sure that the Palestinian Authority kept them in prison. Now, the Palestinian Authority has been voted out, and what we got instead is Hamas. And what we consider terrorists, or what we consider prisoners, they consider freedom fighters. And there's absolutely a total assuredness of when the Palestinian parliament, the new Hamas government, took over, one of the very first things they would do would release these people who they thought were heroes. So we face with a very difficult situation right now, where the Palestinian Authority is gone. And yes, I heard the person speaking from Ramallah earlier on. I agree with him. This has not been good for the Palestinian president, Abbas. But on the other hand, he's so weak, he's so ineffectual, that everybody here felt he wouldn't have the power to go up against Hamas. So we did what we had to do.
What about the other part of the question, and that involves, well, I guess the involvement of the United States and Britain. Nobody believes that this was just a coincidence, that a few minutes after the American and British monitors leave, the Israeli troops arrive.
Well, I think we probably had pretty good intelligence on that. I don't think that's the type of intelligence that's difficult to get. The minute Hamas was voted in, we all knew this was going to be a potential problem. And I think while it may not have been formally coordinated, I think there must have been a nod and a wink here and there that gave each side the understanding they needed.
Mm-hmm.
But all the governments are vociferously denying that there was any cooperation, which probably means there was.
We'll be asking more about the implications for American policy and its credibility in the Palestinian territories after this a little bit later in the program. But let's get another caller on the line. This is Paris. Paris calling us from Seattle.
Yeah, it was more of a question than a comment than a question. Basically, I was going to say this is a case where Omar was sliding in the polls, and he goes in and they raid this prison, and now his poll numbers are jumping, and it's going to make it almost impossible now to have dialogue between the United States and Britain and Hamas when they can't even trust us. I mean, it just looks bad, really bad.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I know it looks the United States and Britain look bad with Hamas, but just the fact of the matter is that you look bad with Hamas even before this, because your policies and that of the entire European community is not to cooperate with Hamas as long as it remains a terrorist organization. If Hamas were to say, okay, we now the Palestinian government, things have happened in the past, Fatah used to be terrorists once and then they became the Palestinian Authority, Israel had its terrorists in 1948, they became part. Okay, we Hamas now recognize Israel, and whatever the case may be, but they, as long as they are a terrorist organization, your laws and the laws of the Europeans do not allow you to interact with Hamas. So this incident is very marginal in terms of that.
It may be marginal in terms of that, but if the United States and Britain are to play a future role in brokering a Middle East peace as honest, as their good offices, as it were, this is going to make that more difficult.
Yes, I agree with that completely. It is going to make it more difficult. It was going to be very difficult to begin with, but this is going to make it more difficult. But like so many things that happen here in the Middle East, this will be a forgotten headline in 2, 3, 4 weeks. Something else will have happened down the road. And it's a dynamic situation. And with what has happened, basically, I think, in terms of Israeli politics as we're going into this election, is that it's not a question in Israel anymore of whether you can make peace, can't make peace, have a partner, don't have a partner, should we, can we. That's not the debate yet. The debate is between the consolidationists and between the expansionists. The consolidationists saying, gee whiskers, now Hamas has been elected there, we're never going to be able to talk to these guys. Let us get out of Gaza, let's build a security barrier, let's consolidate. And between the expansionists who want to keep it all. That is the debate in Israeli society today.
Paris, thanks.
They're basically disengaged from the Palestinians.
Paris, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Hirsch Goodman, I wanted you to elaborate on that last point about really what's being discussed in this election campaign in Israel. What's being put to the Israeli people in terms of relations with the Palestinians?
Okay, well, they're basically, I just say, the social issues are very important in this election here. We've got a ridiculous situation where 30% of the country's wealth is in the hands of 18 families. And the erosion to the middle class and the working class has been significant. So that is an issue, and it's one that's being addressed by all the parties. Security remains a major issue here. The Likud has got a doom and gloom campaign of we can never trust them, we're going to have to fight them for 100 years. There's almost no hope at all in their message. And Labour has got the social issues. And Ulmert is saying, okay, we're going to have to consolidate. We're going to have to give up most of the West Bank. We're going to have to include those large Jewish settlements behind the security barrier. And we'll wait for them to knock on the door, and we'll see if we can sit down and speak. We can sit down and speak. And if we can't, we've got to consolidate and protect ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the leadership, again, you said maybe they're not the most exciting and charismatic leaders in the world. They are all, with the exception of Benjamin Netanyahu, new to us. What are their styles like?
Well, Ehud Olmert has been in politics for 40 years. He has gone from the right wing to the center. He was mayor of Jerusalem for quite a period of time, maybe 8 years. He was an effective mayor, even though not a much loved mayor. He's seen as a strong-armed technocrat. Amir Peretz of the Labour Party has got a labour union background. He's never had any experience in security affairs. And so both those leaders, because of what they're lacking, have got very good teams of people around them. Both parties, you're not going to vote for the leader, you're going to vote for the team that they come with. Mm-hmm. And that's for Kadima and for Labour. With regard to the Likud, you're going to vote for Netanyahu if you believe that there's no hope and that the only way to deal with the situation is to continue to fight and fight and fight and fight.
120 seats in the Israeli Knesset, the parliament. Is any one party likely to get a simple majority?
No, I don't think that can happen. I think Kadima will probably get a... You never know. Just, you know, we're 2 weeks away. I remember in 1996, there were 3 bus bombs over, and overnight, Peres, from a solid lead, lost to Netanyahu. So things can happen here that can change the forecast. But essentially, it looks like Kadima will get about 35 seats, and Labour would get about 20, and that would give them 55, and then they could include a religious party, and that would give them the majority of over 60. And I think that's the most probable coalition to emerge after the election.
A Kadima-led coalition, that would include Labour?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. I think Olmert and Netanyahu have got terrible, terrible personal relations. They really despise each other. And they've been personal political enemies for just too long to get into bed together. I know they say that politics makes strange bedfellows, but this would be beyond strange.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Hirsch Goodman, thanks very much.
It's my pleasure.
Hirsch Goodman, Senior Research Associate at the Jaffe Center for Strategic Studies at Tel Aviv University, political columnist for the Jerusalem Report. He was with us by phone from his home in Tel Aviv. When we come back from a short break, more on Middle East policies and the implications of yesterday's prison raid. Robert Malley, a former Middle East specialist in the Clinton White House, will join us to talk about what this may mean for U.S. relations in the region. We'll also be talking with the savvy traveler, Rudy Maxa, about what airlines are going to charge us for next. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now we're talking about Israel's raid yesterday on a West Bank prison where it seized a Palestinian militant leader and six of his followers. American and British officials deny accusations they colluded with Israel in planning the raid. Palestinians do not believe that. Joining us now to talk about how this affects U.S. policy in the region is Robert Malley, director of the International Crisis Group's Middle East Program, former Special Assistant for Arab-Israeli Affairs under President Clinton. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Always good to be here.
It seems the United States, Britain, and Israel all deny it, but the arrival of Israeli troops just moments after the prison monitors leave defies, it can't be a coincidence.
And at some level, it doesn't really matter. What matters is the perception of the Palestinians. They're convinced that there was collision. One could also say that there was no if the United States and Great Britain really didn't want this to happen. They clearly could have indicated that to Israel. Whether they had prearranged this is another matter, but certainly it was not something that they vigorously objected to.
And no one apparently told the Palestinian Authority. They'd sent letters, many of them, complaining that if conditions don't improve, we'll leave. But nobody sent a letter saying we're going to leave, Tuesday at 6 o'clock in the morning or whenever it was.
No, and in fact, they've said they didn't do that for security reasons. So mm-hmm. I don't think that the Palestinian Authority knew that when it was going to happen.
Obviously, American relations with the Palestinian Authority were not going swimmingly anyway. This is not going to help.
Well, the curious thing about this is that it's unclear what U.S. policy is right now. We know they don't want to have anything to do with a Hamas, and when Hamas takes power, which could be this week, next mm-hmm. week, in a few weeks. But the assumption was they do want to strengthen the moderates. They want to strengthen President Abbas, who is still president. And an action such as this clearly doesn't go in that direction. It's very hard to see how you're going to embolden, strengthen the moderates when something like this happens. It's precisely this kind of humiliation, this kind of feeling from Palestinians that they're being treated in this undignified way that led to Hamas's victory in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And this sort of humiliation, as you put it, the pictures in the newspapers, Israelis cheered, are certainly going to stick in the craw of many Palestinians.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the person who just spoke, Hirsch Goodman, said mm-hmm. this will be forgotten in a week or two. Yes and no. It's cumulative. This is one in a series of incidents that Palestinians will remember. And again, I don't think people should be surprised if the next generation of Palestinians is even more radical than this one.
Mm-hmm. As these negotiations move ahead in terms of the Palestinian Authority, the United States is in a legal quandary. Legally, it cannot transfer funds to a terrorist organization. Hamas is listed as a terrorist organization. Yet we have James Wolfensohn, the Middle East envoy, the head of the quartet, so-called, the United States, Europe, the UN, and Russia, testifying before Congress today. If you have 1 million Palestinians and kids in the street, how can there be peace? Kids won't have schools, and there will be chaos in the streets. Now, he also says you can't deal with Hamas until it changes its stripes. But he's also pointing out that this is going to be a recipe for disaster.
Absolutely. What he's trying to say is we need to find ways to set up maybe a parallel system to provide humanitarian and basic goods that the Palestinians need in health and education and everyday necessities. And that's what he's pushing for. He's pushing for more time, more flexibility to be able to do that. I also think we need to think of ways, not necessarily the United States, but other countries, to test Hamas. Is it able to evolve, to move gradually in a direction that will allow other countries to provide the kind of support that we can't.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly, it was posed in some of the opinion columns today, saying that in previous times Israel was for a sort of limited agreement with the Palestinians, not the right time to settle on the final issues of Jerusalem, Israel's final borders, that sort of thing. But now with Hamas, it might be the exact right time to try to challenge the Palestinians to say, all right, let's go to a final settlement.
Well, it may be. I mean, it would be interesting if you did put a final settlement on the table to see how Hamas would react. It would put them in a much more difficult position than they are right now, because the Palestinian public polls say about 70% of them would accept a two-state solution along the lines that have been discussed in past peace negotiations. Well, let's see whether Hamas would say no to that. But we're so far from there. I mean, the fact is, ironically, both Hamas and the current Israeli leadership have, in some ways, a convergence of views. They don't want to talk to each other. They don't want to negotiate with one another. And they don't believe right now in a permanent status agreement.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Lloyd. Lloyd's with us from Redding in California.
Hi. I have a question. I don't understand how the United States cannot support a democratically elected leader such as Hamas. I understand they're considered a terrorist organization, but when you see Israelis going into prisons and also openly saying that they're going to attack leaders of Hamas, I don't see how we cannot see that as either a war crime or as an act of terrorism as well. The definition of a terrorist depends on who has the bigger weapons.
That's not the only definition of a terrorist, but Lloyd will accept your rhetorical point for the moment. But he's right. I mean, the United States touts democracy in the Middle East, and when the people you don't like get elected, the United States says, we can't deal with you.
Well, you know, I'd give two answers. Number one, it's true. Sometimes people get elected democratically that we want to have nothing to do with, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, if the fascists win in some European country, I don't think that we would be dealing with them. The question is whether we're perceived as deliberately trying to sabotage and undermine this government, because that would send the message not only to Palestinians but to the Middle East as a whole that we are not serious about democracy, and that if democracy yields results we don't like, it's not only that we don't deal with them, we go out of our way to undermine them, which is why I think we have to be very careful in how we act right now.
Lloyd, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
But in the calculation of Palestinian politics, at least as dimly as I understand it, this raid yesterday will redound to the benefit of Hamas and undermine the moderate President Abbas.
In immediate, yes. I mean, I'm not sure how much it helps Hamas, because Hamas is not perceived as being able to do anything about it. They probably won't retaliate, because it would hurt their chances of in the next government. So, but it definitely hurts President Abbas, and that's one of the unfortunate consequences.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk now with Bob. Bob's calling us from New York City.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Hey, listen, the Palestinian people democratically elected a terrorist organization to be their representative. Now, if we were to enter Europe or to aid this organization, we would be aiding and abetting terrorism. And my final comment, and I'll take the rest of your comments off the air, is they made their bed. Now let them die or lie in it, as the case may be.
Bob, thanks. That's the argument that many make, that Hamas should be allowed to fail, and then perhaps a more mainstream group in Palestinian politics might be elected.
Well, first of all, as I said, there's no talk about us aiding or abetting this government. The question is, will its failure automatically be an American success? And I would argue that if they fail, and the Palestinians are convinced that they failed because we and the Israelis engineered their failure, then you will not have a Palestinian people that are going to turn to more moderates. They will be more radical. They won't blame Hamas. They will blame Israel and the U.S. for the downfall of the government. You will not have a greater support for democracy or for the moderates or the pragmatists. Mm-hmm. You know, despair and this political disillusionment got us to where we are now. I'm not saying under what logic we think that despair and disillusionment is going to somehow lead the Palestinians to vote for Fatah. If anything, they'll try to find a more radical voice.
And James Wolfison, in his testimony, said pretty much along those same lines today, and added, quote, "I do not believe you can have a million starving Palestinians and have peace."
And that's absolutely right. You can't have a million starving Palestinians. You can't have people without jobs who are then going to say, well, we're going to vote for those who led us for the last 30 years and who weren't able to get us much anyway.
Rob Malley, thanks very much for being with us. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Robert Malley is director of the International Crisis Group's Middle East program, and he was kind enough to join us here today in Studio 3A. When we come back, The Savvy Traveler.